Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Weekly Pulse. I'm Jeff Snyder, your host for the next 40-plus minutes as we go around the globe to discuss the issues related to retirement, the markets, technology, and personal finance. We've got another great show for you. We've got a very special guest. His name is Michael Bozzello. He's the product manager for StockTwits. And if you don't know what StockTwits is, well, check out the interview. It's going to be really interesting. And, of course, we're going to hear from our all-stars who will help us identify, digest, and understand the latest trends and news in the market today. So sit back, relax, and enjoy this episode of The Weekly Pulse. Well, we're going to kick things off, as we always do, with a look around the world of social media trends. Joining me now, as always, Mr. Devin Banerjee. He's a senior finance editor with LinkedIn, and he's joining us from San Francisco, California. Hey, Devin, how are you, bud?
I'm doing great this week. How are you, Jeff?
I'm doing great. You know, some technical difficulties today, but it's all good, and I'm happy. Hope you had a good Halloween.
Yeah, you too. I hope you did, too.
Yeah, I did. I did. I dressed up as a cat. Just kidding. So what's going on? Lots to talk about. There's a jobs report today, but what's top of mind for you on the social media platforms that you're following, including LinkedIn, of course?
Yeah, we saw some really interesting conversations this week. One of them goes back to something, Jeff, that you and I spoke about 2 months ago, which was when Nike appointed Colin Kaepernick as a brand ambassador. So there was this interesting report out of the public relations firm Edelman this week that showed that these belief-driven firms, so companies that take a stand on political or social issues, you actually see a conversion, you actually see action taken on their sales and stock prices. So Edelman found that 64% of consumers globally feel that a company's stand on prominent societal or political issues actually affects what they buy. And that's up 13 percentage points from just the previous year. So, you know, going back to the conversation we had around Nike about 2 months ago, we're really seeing consumers actually act on these beliefs they have about political and societal stands that companies take. So really interesting. It has a ton of ramifications for the way C-suites and management teams think about taking these stands and really putting a stamp on their corporate culture and their corporate beliefs.
Yeah, you know, I know you follow this as well. You know, ESG, so-called ESG investments, where they're really focused on social consciousness, has also been very popular. You see a lot of activist shareholders with companies, and it's really interesting to see. And I just wonder what is going to become all of this. You know, how much can you drive through this? So I guess interesting study, interesting numbers. Seems like it's working. You know, I think people want to belong in society, make a contribution, and so that seems to me like that's where things are going.
Yeah, absolutely. I actually didn't plan to discuss this, but since you brought it up, there was an interesting tweet this week from Chris Ailman, who's the chief investment officer of the California State Teachers Retirement Fund, which I think is up to about $230 billion in assets. Anyway, he posted a selfie and said that he was touring an ICE detention facility, which is run by a for-profit company in which the CalSTRS sort of passive allocation is invested in. And he is someone I've interviewed him several times who thinks about taking an activist stance and you know, taking the ESG issues that CalSTRS cares about and applying them to even its passive portfolio. So just sort of a sidetrack there, but something, as you said, is really taking hold among big companies and institutional investors.
Yeah, absolutely. More to come on that.
Yeah. Another trend we saw with a lot of conversation this week is this interesting trend around looking for a job when you already have one. So Business Insider had this interesting report out that really sparked a lot of conversation, which is it found that there are some companies out there, like Netflix, actually, where managers actually encourage or will help some of their employees look for other jobs while they're already working at a place like Netflix. So this obviously sparked debate on both ends of the spectrum, people opposed to this, people in favor of this. Some of the people in favor of it say that a company can use it as a learning experience and they can sort of sit down with these employees and figure out where the gap is in terms of what these employees want and what they're receiving at the current company. Companies can take comfort if employees are sort of aspirational and looking to move on to really reputable companies. And some managers like to sort of create a network using these employees of other employees at different companies and hiring managers at different companies. So just something I never thought I would sort of see out there, but a real interesting trend that we're seeing at some technology companies, including Netflix.
Yeah, interesting. It kind of goes back to the conversation we had last week on the other side. Remember we talked about Glassdoor, and I think open. Look, it should be open dialogues. I think the old paradigm doesn't work anymore. People are moving around jobs. It's kind of a gig economy. People want to continue to better themselves. The more transparency, I think we would all agree, and be interesting to see how people weigh in. We would all agree is a good thing, and helping people get to where they should be and could be, that's part of the job of a manager. And why would you want unhappy people at your organization? It means lower customer service. That's what exactly it means.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and it goes back to what we talked about last week, as you said, which is just people want more transparency. Some companies are interested in putting out there how much people earn or salaries or aggregated data on salaries. So just it's this trend of transparency, which I think is an irreversible trend. Another issue that we saw spark a lot of conversation this week was this report out about the U.S. workforce. So one of the big segments of the U.S. workforce that has not sort of recovered since the financial crisis are millennial males. So men aged 25 to 34 have not sort of returned to their workforce participation levels that we saw pre-crisis. And what's most interesting is some of the reasons for this that economists point to. That includes fewer high-paying jobs in manufacturing and mining, obviously industries that have had a difficult time from a secular standpoint. We're seeing more young adults living at home. These two I found really interesting. Better video games, actually. Economists are and labor economists are actually pointing to this big trend of video games as keeping millennial men out of the workforce. And another reason, which is, obviously a very unfortunate reason, is this opioid epidemic that we're seeing across the country. So just something really interesting for companies big and small to think about in terms of workforce participation. It's these millennial men, so men aged 25 to 34, who have not really returned to the workforce participation levels.
Oh wow, that's really unfortunate. Good data. Hopefully, people can begin to develop programs, and I don't know if incentives are the right terminology because I'm definitely not for bailing people out, but trying to help train people and get people thinking about, this show is all about saving, and if you're not working, that means you're not earning a living. That means you're not potentially saving and not gaining financial independence. And we want everyone in society to do that because it helps all of us. And so it's going to be really interesting to see what we can do to kind of change the tide, just like we have the gender gap in terms of earnings for women, and we have retirement savings gender gaps as well. So, it's unfortunate statistics, but I'm glad that we're talking about it, and hopefully the issue keeps being raised and we can figure out some solutions.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree.
Well, DB, always a pleasure talking with you, as always. Wish you a very great week, and I know we're going to talk to each other a little bit later on and a little special thing we've got going on, so I don't want to tease out too much, but always a pleasure, always great insight from you and the folks at LinkedIn. Have a great weekend.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Jeff. I'm excited to talk to you later today, and have a great weekend as well.
Thanks, bud.
Bye-bye. Before I have to pull the strap off the cut, give me the microphone first so I can
bust like a bubble. Captain and Lone Beach together. Welcome back, and it's always great to talk technology, and she is back, Ms. Natalie Walters from The Motley Fool. Hi, Natalie. How are you?
Good. Glad to be here. It's a busy season for us right now with earnings.
Yeah, it is earnings season. I know you've been really busy. I've been following your articles. And so what's top of mind for you and the folks at The Motley Fool?
Yeah, I thought it'd be interesting to look at Snapchat because we haven't talked about that in a bit on the show. So for their earnings, their daily active users actually slipped 1% from the last quarter. But it's also been making some positive changes. So there are also some positive figures that came out of the earnings. For example, 60% of their DAUs are creating snaps every day. Their trailing 12-month revenue is up 53%. And their shows feature that offers original content actually reached a monthly audience of 10 million people. So it's, you know, I don't know if you remember we talked about this at the beginning of the year, but they released a redesign that really backfired because nobody liked it. People had gotten used to this old design. They said the new design was difficult to use and confusing. And so Snap had to kind of walk back on that and make some changes and adjust so it wasn't, so it didn't lose followers and lose its audience. And so it said it's been making those changes, and it's also adding new features like the shows feature where people can, you know, watch 3 to 7 minute shows, you know, kind of in the way of Netflix. And they have other features, like they've been adding in AR games, you know, just things to increase engagement. Right now, people spend an average of 30 minutes a day on Snapchat.
Wow.
So hopefully with these features, I'm guessing by next year that will increase if it, you know, if it does it the right way.
Yeah, so, you know, just based on all of our conversations, one of the things that you're always talking about when you're thinking about earnings, you're always mentioning the word subscribers or users. And I would imagine, and I'm just, you know, I'm naive on this, but I would imagine that in an advertising heavy business, it's very important to make sure that you've got eyeballs on your content. Because if not, you're just you're irrelevant, I guess, to some extent.
Right, exactly. And advertisers aren't going to want to use your platform for their ads. And so one thing that's really helped Snapchat, you know, raise its revenue is that it switched to a self-service advertising model a few years ago. And so its ad revenue has really shot up since it did that. And this past quarter, about 80% of its ad revenue was through its self-service offering. Because, you know, it's more affordable. And so some of the smaller companies that weren't able to afford ads through Snapchat earlier, they can now do that. And that's really helped it.
Interesting. Let me ask you a question. So, you know, there's Snap, there's Instagram, there's Facebook. I mean, what is the demographic of people who use Snap? I mean, would people my age, you know, Gen Xers, or they tend to be like Gen Z, Gen Y? What are the typical breakdown of people who use that application?
Right. It definitely skews younger. And, you know, I would say anywhere from, you know, like really like 14 to maybe 30. And that was part of the effort with the redesign, is they were hoping the redesign earlier this year would help bring in some older users so they could continue to grow their audience, you know, because there's only so far you can grow with just that limited age group. And they want to be more like Facebook, where everybody, they can kind of reach out to everybody.
But my understanding, and I know you have another topic to talk about, but my understanding with Facebook is that actually millennials and those that were the newer generation, Gen Z, were actually fleeing that social network, because what was cool for people of my age and maybe younger and some older, a lot of the younger folks didn't want to be seen doing things in front of their parents' generation. So, you know, I can understand. I mean, the goal of when we're talking about Netflix, the goal is to increase subscribers, and you get to this point where there's, you know, diminishing returns, and you need to continue to add people. You know, if you add everybody in the United States, for example, a great majority, and you start looking to develop countries, you may not get as many subscribers. So there's like a cap. And the same thing I think would hold true. If you're just appealing to millennials or younger, now you miss all the mature folks, we'll call them, above that age.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And people, right, you said, like you said, younger people are fleeing Facebook. And, you know, this is just my opinion. There's not actually evidence for this, but I sort of see Snapchat as for the age group even below me, and I'm 25. And then Instagram is for people around my age and a little younger, a little older. And then Facebook is kind of for the older people. It kind of, that's kind of how I see it. But then, of course, there's gray areas where, you know, some people are on all three of them.
Well, let me be clear before we move on to the last story. We've got a minute left. Is that the Morning Pulse is for all ages. Weekly Pulse, the Morning Pulse, it is for everybody, because everybody should be thinking about retirement and savings. Okay, so let's shift gears from Snap, and I think you wanted to talk a little bit about Apple, who had a big release this week.
Yeah, I was just going to mention a quick thing on Apple, just because they released earnings today. And they sold about as many iPhones this quarter as they did a year ago. despite them, you know, raising iPhone prices. And that's kind of been a trend we've been seeing with Apple. And it's just interesting because their revenue is still able to rise year over year, even though they're selling, you know, about the same number of iPhones. So that's because, you know, people are keeping their iPhones longer because there's not as much difference mm-hmm. between each new iPhone. And so people think, oh, why do I need to pay for a new iPhone when I basically have the same thing, you know? I'm not going to buy an iPhone just for a slightly better camera.
Yeah, I mean,
if people don't understand that, so they're able to still raise their revenue just by raising the prices of their iPhones. So even if they don't sell, you know, a hugely significant amount, they're still able to grow their revenue and make investors happy.
Yeah, and that incrementalism, I wonder if that road of incrementalism kind of wears itself out over time, because Apple has always been known to be cutting edge and developing new concepts. And, you know, candidly, just to kind of wrap up the segment, you know, I went and looked at the new iPhone XS, XR, X Max, whatever the new one is, and I couldn't justify moving. I have the iPhone 10. Mm-hmm. I couldn't justify, you know, I don't do a lot with it. I'm looking at the time to count down our segments, look at my email, but I couldn't justify spending that kind of money for a new phone, even though it was beautiful. And I'm sure it's going to be better than what I had. So
exactly. I'm actually in the same position as you. I have the 10 and I didn't even really look closely at the new iPhones because I knew it wasn't. I kind of saw the features and was like, yeah, I think I'm good. I'm good for another year.
Well, Natalie Walters, always a pleasure talking with you on a Friday afternoon. And thank you so much for your contributions and expertise. And like Devin Banerjee, I'm going to be talking to you a little later on our new little endeavor, which we're not going to talk too much about here. So have a good weekend, and I will see you, of course, later.
Great, look forward to it.
Thank you. Take care. Bye.
Thanks. Bye. Ready to make an entrance, so back on lip. Before I have to pull the strap off the cut. Give me the microphone first so I can bust like a bubble. Hopping in Long Beach together, now you know you in trouble because ain't nothing but a joke.
Welcome back, everyone. And it's now time for our markets segment. Joining me now from Scottsdale, Arizona, he's the president of Money Alignment Academy and an independent investment advisor, Mr. George Grombacher. And from New York City, he's a principal with Delphi Digital. His name is Mr. Kevin Kelly. Guys, how are you?
Doing great. Happy Friday.
Happy Friday. How was your Halloween?
Well, it was filled with trick-or-treating. My 2-year-old son loved it. He dressed up like a penguin.
A penguin. Very cute. Very cute. And Kevin, I don't even want to ask this of you, but what did you dress up as?
I don't want to disappoint here. My girlfriend and I went as Danny and Sandy from Grease, pretty classic couples costume. What was great about that was I spent absolutely no money on it. So I basically put on a black V-neck, some dark jeans, and called myself Danny Zuko with some gel in my hair.
Did you guys sing?
We did not. I asked for it at the old bar. I asked for the song to be played, but got nothing. So
What I was thinking about your costume, I actually thought of you with like a T-Birds outfit, you know, the T-Birds.
Yeah, I've been a greaser before. I did that back in college, I think, 1 year. But, it was good. It was an easy costume. It was a lot of fun.
Well, are you into musicals, Kevin?
To be honest with you, I'm not. Okay. I am a greaser. No, that's a secret.
Well, I should point out that Oliver Rennick, who normally is on this segment as well, is unable to join us. He's got another commitment. So, guys, Kevin, I'm going to come to you first. We had jobs numbers. We're recording this as of Friday afternoon. By all accounts, excellent job numbers, 250,000 jobs added, wage growth of 3.1%. So I want to get your assessment of that and then other macro and developing market themes that you may want to share with the audience.
Yeah, absolutely. To your point, I mean, the jobs number came in pretty stellar today. The 250K that was added this month, I think, is definitely the standout number, the headline number. But to your point, the over 3% now year-over-year growth in wages is what really caught my eye, to be honest. There's been this conversation about, you know, inflation expectations kind of been a little bit muddled in recent weeks, despite, you know, some of the inflationary pressures that we talked about domestically here, you know, in the U.S. And Oliver, this is a point that he's hit on, you know, a number of times. But you're starting to get this interesting dynamic between people who, you know, you see the stock market, obviously it still has not rebounded and come close to where it was even, you know, last month, the end of last month, before kind of falling off a cliff here. A little bit of a bounce back, but nothing too significant, even off this jobs number. I mean, the market's down. So what's interesting here is I think you still have a lot of people in the market that expect the Fed to continue on the course of rate hikes, despite what the president, you know, comes out and tweets, despite what the president wants, and argues that it'll choke off economic growth here. I think with a wage number, wage inflation number like that, I mean, the Fed is pretty much, you know, come hell or high water, gonna raise rates again here in December. Unless something pretty kind of almost catastrophic happens, or some of the data really, really starts to turn between now and then, but I just don't see that happening. So I think that'll probably continue to weigh on stocks. Again, as rates rise, you know, the attractiveness of stocks compared to, let's say, you know, fixed income, 10-year treasury bonds, more, you know, typically classified as safer assets, that comparison becomes a little bit more narrow, right? And sometimes you might have a reallocation into, you know, some of these 10-year bonds that now yield, you know, upwards of 3%. Which we haven't seen in a pretty long time. So I think that's definitely something that the markets are going to be watching going forward.
So George, let me come to you. 156 million Americans are working. That's a great thing. I want to get your reaction to that. And I know you're very passionate about helping Americans save and plan. So I want you to kind of tie it back to that, because that's a passion of yours as well.
Yeah, for sure. And you start trying to get your brain around percentages and numbers like we were just talking about, and it's not always easy to do. And I sometimes think that when the average American hears that there's a 3.1% wage growth, it sort of washes over them and they think, well, what does that really have to do with me? And as we know, it doesn't necessarily mean that everybody's wages went up by 3.1%, but let's just kind of assume that they did, and what that impact might be. If the average or the median American household income is $59,039, which it is, and you were to apply a 3.1% growth to that, that would be about $1,800 a year, or $150 a month. And that could be a very meaningful amount. If you marry that to another number, let's say that the average American satellite TV subscriber pays about $100 a month. So there's another $1,200 a year. Add that to the $1,800, that's $3,000 a year. And that is a meaningful number. You take that $3,000, put that into a savings account or an IRA, a 401k, 30 years later at 6%, that's $240,000. And when you look at it in terms of that, actually taking the statistics and crunching the numbers and making it digestible, that is a difference-making number. So for everybody who's listening, who's trying to get their arms around that, small bites.
Oh, great job, George, on that. Kevin, you know, your firm does a lot of digital asset research, and I think one of the things we want to explore on this show, you know, we always talk about the markets. But I want to ask you to give an update on what you're seeing from a research perspective for digital assets. We talked about Fidelity, getting into the cryptocurrency world. Take us through what your takeaways for the week are. And I'll get George's reaction on that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'll use just kind of Bitcoin as the standard here to kind of summarize some of the big takeaways we've seen recently within digital assets. But, you know, there's been this argument that, you know, it's going to take something like a massive stock sell-off, not only here in the U.S., but globally, to really kind of kickstart the interest again in the digital asset cryptocurrency realm, which we haven't been big proponents on. We think that, you know, institutional investors and you know, sophisticated investors in general really view this asset class or emerging asset class still higher out on the risk spectrum than even, you know, high yield debt, equities, things that we've talked about on this program before. So we haven't been in the camp that, you know, a stock sell-off would necessarily be good for cryptocurrencies. But what we have seen is the volatility of these things. And again, I'll use Bitcoin just kind of as the benchmark. The volatility of Bitcoin, when you compare that to some of these other riskier assets, again, like the equity markets, whether it's emerging markets or even the S&P 500, the volatility has actually come down pretty drastically in the last, you know, couple months here. So that's one thing that we've been looking for. Again, it's the argument that, you know, cryptocurrencies and these types of things to transfer value and be, you know, mediums of exchange simply wouldn't it's not possible for that to occur until you have, you know, a much more stable outlook for these things. And what we're seeing in the price action is as the volatility drops, we're hoping that this starts to, you know, kind of refuel some of the institutional interest in these types of things, just kind of at a very broad level. So that's what we're watching for. You know, it's not that the digital asset market's really taken off, but it hasn't really sold off as much as you've seen even some of the stock markets here globally. So that was an interesting takeaway that we think, again, we remained, you know, pretty constructive on this market, obviously, over the long term.
So, George, break it down for us. You did a great job in the last part of this segment on the jobs numbers, but just break it down. I mean, the average Americans hearing about crypto, hearing about Bitcoin, Ethereum, Ripple, all the things that Kevin's talking about, mostly institutional players, I would suspect, some millennials getting into it. But what's your takeaway on what Kevin just said and what your thoughts are about it?
Yeah, I think it's a matter of going from zero to a million miles an hour, right? Because I think that the majority of Americans had no idea what crypto or blockchain was a year or two ago. And now you follow the money, and there's so much money that seems to be flowing in different organizations that are popping up. And then you get the Fidelities of the world or other major institutional players who are starting to really invest. So it's just, I think it's just going to continue and become more mainstream and more accepted. And I think that most people are excited about it.
Well, great. Guys, thank you so much. Appreciate your insight as always. Hope you have a great rest of the day, great weekend, and we're looking forward to catching up with you next week.
Thanks, Joe.
Bye, guys. Welcome back, and we're going to be talking markets, and we've got a great segment planned with Michael Bozzello. He is the product manager for StockTwits. Michael, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Jeff. Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Always a pleasure. And I think I'd like to start off with what exactly – some of our audience may not be familiar with what StockTwits is. So would you mind just starting there, and then we can kind of get into some of the trends you're seeing?
Sure, absolutely. So StockTwits is the largest social network for investors and traders. We have over 1.6 million registered users. We're doing – about 170,000 daily active users a day and about 200,000 messages a day. So we have streams which are set up for individual stock tickers, futures, indices, crypto, Forex, you name it. There's a stream for it which helps organize the information. And StockTwits is actually the creator of the cash tag. So if you're not familiar with StockTwits and you may be on Twitter, you might see the dollar sign and then the ticker symbol like AAPL. And this is how people chat on StockTwits about their individual stocks or what they're looking at.
So obviously a very relevant and important social network, but a social network focused on trading. And I would imagine there's a lot of investor sentiment and information that is gathered throughout the day. And so you have your pulse on your investor on the investors.
Yeah, this is absolutely correct. So another feature and key feature and reason people like to use us is because of our investor sentiment. So with each individual message, somebody can tag bullish or bearish, which seems very simple, right? You have your thesis, you're bullish or bearish, you're tagging maybe it's Apple, maybe it's Netflix after earning. But what we're doing is we're tracking those messages and we're also tracking the sentiment with it. So at any time you can go over and you can go to a stream of the stock you're interested in and see what investor and trader sentiment is for those hundreds of thousands of potential watchers, traders, and investors on that stream.
So let's, you know, we have a market segment every week with Oliver Rennick, Kevin Kelly, and George Grombacher, where we talk about what's going on at a macro level. And we don't ever talk about, we're not here to recommend particular securities, stocks, bonds, et cetera. I know it's a heavily compliance regulated environment for you as well. So what are some of the key themes and trends that you're seeing across the StockTwits universe?
Sure. So for us right now, it's all earnings, right? So earnings for StockTwits is huge. It's when we see our most amount of traffic. And I think that's really what everybody's gearing up for. We saw bank stocks report. The same stocks got kicked off yesterday with Netflix. We saw IBM. And it's just going to keep going from here. So all the chatter right now is really heavily focused on earnings.
And how much, you know, the Fed is, you know, as the time of we're recording this show, the Fed has its meeting, but we've also seen rising rates. How does the StockTwits universe react to that type of conversation?
Yeah, so I think it's pretty interesting. I think, you know, you're always going to see when we have big market down days like we saw last week that there's a lot of people who start to get a little bit fearful. But we just see it time and time again, year after year right now, especially during when we've seen our biggest boom in user growth, that people are not really afraid of the markets and they think that they're going higher. Again, there's both sides of it, but we really see people sort of being very resilient, and then they're on to the next thing. So when Fed comes into focus, people are certainly chatting about it, but now it's earnings season, so people are focused on earnings season. I think whatever the topic is at hand, whether it's Trump, Fed, earnings, people are hopping one to the other pretty quickly.
Yeah, and the world now is – and I think what's interesting about your network, because I'm going to call it a network. It is a social network in a way, or
yep.
It is. But, you know, there's a lot going on. So you have volatility in the market, and we're very data-driven now. So there's a lot of – you know, people read and hear about high-frequency trading and quantitative trading and using quantitative factors. There's a lot of information that gets kind of passed along that is very quantitative, I would imagine.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think why a lot of people also use our streams is because it sort of levels the playing field, right? If news is coming out and you have to wait for a big news outlet to sort of, you know, piece it together and deliver to you, you know, as a trader, as an investor, you want that information as fast as possible, right? You want that that edge as well as everybody else. So when there's breaking news, people are on the streams, they're discussing it, they're putting it out there very quickly. You're able to get a diverse amount of opinions, whether they're bullish or bearish. So there's all this great information and all this great data that is coming through our network on a daily basis. And it's really incredible from the amount of images that are shared just to the amount of investor sentiment that's shared daily.
And I would – do you have a typical demographic? I mean, are these all – quote unquote day traders, or are these people that could just be, you know, husbands and wives, or, you know, younger, mature? I mean, is there a specific demographic that you're looking at?
Yeah. So our biggest demographic is the millennial. So it's, you know, the mid 20 something to early 30s. Again, we do see a lot of investors, a lot of traders. So it's not just day traders. We have long-term investors that are discussing their portfolios that they're growing. But our large demographic is millennials, but you know, we're growing 50% year over year. So it's a really, really big demographic. And I think it's a really important demographic too.
And do you also create content? So, you know, a lot of the networks, and you look at something like a LinkedIn or Twitter, people are putting content out there. So it might be videos, might be a podcast like this one. It might be an article. Do people also put that across the network as well?
Yeah, so we have our marketing team, our social team. They're extremely active. I think, you know, we have a really fun, you know, view on the market. So we sort of take things very lighthearted, but also very seriously. So we like to share great memes that are shared on the site, great videos. We have a big Instagram and Twitter following. And a lot of the content that we do share comes from within our network itself. So, mm-hmm. you know, a lot of our job internally is to sort of bubble up that great content so that we can get more eyes on it.
Last question. I saw Mr. Rosen appear. He's the CEO of StockTwits. I saw him appear on TD Ameritrade Network with Mr. Oliver Rennick, one of our contributors on the show, talking about cannabis. Is this something that you know, actually today is a voting day. People will vote on cannabis around the country. Is this a trend that you see being talked about on the social network?
Sure. Yeah. So first of all, I love Oliver and his show, and it was great to see Ian on. Yeah. So the cannabis trend and theme has been just absolutely incredible to see. The message volume has been, you know, we were doing 10 to 20, 25,000 messages a day on Tilray during that very volatile time in mid-September. So I think right now everybody's sort of on the edge of their seat. I know early this morning some of the cannabis stocks were getting hit. So the chatter is definitely very high, and I think it's going to be a really interesting to see what happens in Canada and see how it plays out here in the market.
Well, great. Well, Michael, thank you so much for sharing insight into this, the World Wide Web, the equivalent of a new network, or not a new network, but the network known as StockTwits. We appreciate it. Thanks for sharing some of the investor sentiment, not non-specific investor sentiment, because we want to keep above board from a compliance perspective. And we hope to have you back very soon.
Thanks, Jeff. Great to be here.
Take care. Have a great week.
You too. Bye-bye. Before I have to pull the strap off the cut. Give me the microphone
first so I can bust like a bubble. And Lone Beach together. Welcome back. And now it is time for our personal finance segment. And joining us now from Dow Jones Market Watch is Miss Alessandra Melito. Hi, Allie. How are you?
Hi, how are you? I'm good.
I'm doing great. And before we get into your segment, I want to just congratulate you and the folks at MarketWatch. 40 million unique subscribers or unique web hits on your website.
Yeah.
Congratulations. That's a major mark.
Yeah, I'm super, super proud of MarketWatch. It was all because of all the great work on all the different teams. Everybody was super involved, and it was good. At 40 million unique visitors, that's a big deal, I think.
Absolutely. Well, yeah, 40 million is nothing to sneeze at. And I also saw, I think you tweeted out a picture that the Wall Street Journal had a MarketWatch section this week, right?
Yeah, so it was called Best New Ideas in Money. It was a section that we had, like a special section that we had done on the web first, and then the Wall Street Journal picked it up in their print edition on Monday. And it just touched on, it had a bunch of different stories that touched on some of the newest things going on in money. So, like, I wrote about state-sponsored retirement plans, and there were stories that touched on healthcare and technology and all of that.
Well, great. So keep up the good work. And so let's kind of get into this week. I mean, there's obviously a lot of news. One thing that we heard yesterday was the Internal Revenue Service released the new contribution limits for retirement plans, IRAs, et cetera. So I know you kind of took a look at this. And what are your thoughts and the MarketWatch's thoughts on this?
So I thought it was great. The limits are now $19,000 for 401ks and an additional $6,000 for if you're 50 or older, and then IRAs are $6,000 now as opposed to $5,500, which was the first time that the IRS has increased the IRA limit in 6 years. So that's cool.
Wow.
And then an additional $1,000 for people 50 and older. Of course, as somebody who writes about retirement all the time, I say that people should take this with caution. Even though a lot of people already don't max out 401ks as it is, $19,000 or $25,000 is probably the least that people should be saving for retirement. Just because you're gonna need a lot of money in retirement, it's not just what you want to do with your time, like going on vacation or like, you know, paying off a mortgage or rent or whatever. It's also healthcare that's very expensive in retirement, and just all the unexpected things that usually come in the time span of like 10 or 20 years, which nowadays people are living so much longer than they used to. So you should be expecting to live in retirement more than just, you know, a few years. It could be 10 years, it could be 15 years, it could even be 20 or 30 years, depending on when you retire and your health. So.
Yeah, and I just saw a number, I think it was the Employee Benefit Research Institute, Lori Lucas's team over there, put out a number. I want to say it was $399,000 for people of retirement age in terms of spending for healthcare. So every little bit, I think, you know, as we talk about on the show, and I know I love the fact that you're passionate about saving and financial planning. You know, start early and save often. I mean, that's all.
Yeah.
That's all. It's a very simple equation. Start early, save often, and you will be in a much better place when you get to your 40s, 50s, and 60s.
Yeah, absolutely.
So let's shift gears. We're not going to really talk about politics, but one of the things that came up is the president's potential for an executive order that could impact the 14th, I think the 14th Amendment. And, you know, I think you did a little bit of a deep dive and assessed I don't want to minimize your contribution, of course, but you did a deep dive on this and to assess what the impact could be to American society, to immigration and employee benefits and savings.
Yeah. So I thought it was interesting to look at what the economic or financial impact could be on immigrants or the babies of immigrants if this executive order were to happen and if it were to be approved. It's important to note that a lot of people say that it cannot actually, even if he does sign an executive order, it can't actually do anything immediately because it's a constitutional issue. So in that case, it would have to go through the courts. But either way, I looked at like what would the impact possibly be if this happened. And I spoke to some professors who said that, politics and immigration professors, who said that it could essentially create a second class of citizens. If the birthright citizenship policy were to end with basically birthright citizenship and saying anybody born in the U.S. is a citizen, if that were to end, these people would still obviously be in the U.S. if they're born in the U.S., but they wouldn't have all the rights that come with being a U.S. citizen. So it wouldn't affect schooling, but it could possibly affect jobs when these kids get older because they might not have rights to certain documents like driver's license or birth certificates and things like that. And that obviously is a requirement for a lot of jobs, even jobs for teenagers. And then, let's see, I also looked at one report that suggested that if this were to happen and people were in, they were denied citizenship because both parents' legal statuses, that there would be another 16 million undocumented people in the U.S. by 2050. That was from a Migration Policy Institute report. So it's just there are a lot of possibilities with this executive order, but of course it doesn't mean anything's happening right now. Just a consideration.
And also keep in mind, we've got the midterm elections next Tuesday. So we're recording this on a Friday afternoon. It's about 1:51 p.m. Eastern time. And we, of course, have the U.S. midterms. And so a lot has to shake out there from the, you know, what the House of Representatives is going to look like in the U.S. Senate. So, you know, more to come on this. And it'll be interesting to get your assessment and the Market Watch's team's assessment next week, Allie, on what happens with retirement legislation potentially as a result of some of the changes we experience on Tuesday.
Oh, yeah, I plan on looking at some of the candidates and what their platforms are for, like, seniors and for just retirement savings overall. Surprisingly, not a lot of people actually put that as part of their platform, at least not a specific item on their platforms. They might mention Social Security, but they don't actually say much about this, like, whole retirement crisis that's on our hands. But I am hoping to find some candidates who will gladly talk about retirement because I'm all that.
I know you are. And she is Miss Allie Melito. Allie, thank you so much and have a great day and a great weekend.
Ready to make an entrance, so back on live. Before I have to pull the strap off the cut. Give me the
microphone first so I can bust like a bubble. Captain and Lone Beast together. Welcome back, and now it's time for our Legal Eagles segment. And joining me from New York City are the Eagles. We've got David Levine and Kevin Walsh of Groom Law Group. Hey guys, how are you? Happy Halloween.
We're good. Happy Halloween. It's always good to be on, and I know the election's next week, but since we're up in New York this week, we thought we'd focus on kind of hot topics outside of politics, and next week we can do our deep dive into the election.
Great. That's awesome. So, David, what's top of mind for the Eagles?
So top of mind this week, thanks, Jeff, is something a little different. We've all been hearing the discussion in the marketplace about the rise of health savings accounts. For those who are familiar, you know that it's basically a savings vehicle to pay for healthcare costs. You can use it every year. It's often used as employers roll out high deductible health coverage. But a lot of the discussion, I'll call it in the retirement space, is that, oh, this is a way to save on a tax-free type of way all the way to your retirement and use this money in your retirement. But this week, there was some more guidance on another type of health savings style account, the health reimbursement account. We're not going to go super deep on HRAs, but we figured with all the interest being paid to HSAs, it's good for people to be aware of HRAs. Health reimbursement arrangements were sort of created as a name and blessed by the IRS and the Department of the Treasury in the early 2000s, basically as a way employers could do, this will sound very familiar to all of us who do retirement, defined contribution health care before even health savings accounts. Now, with the Affordable Care Act, there were some IRS rules that were put out that made it, in the view of many, less favorable to offer a health reimbursement arrangement to employees. Well, with the Trump administration, just like we've talked about association retirement plans, which are similar to association health plans, they also directed, back in 17, the president directed that the agencies look at ways to expand the use of things like HRAs. As I say again, like a sidecar, kind of like HSAs. And HRAs recently got their guidance. It took a little while, but the IRS and Treasury and the other agencies involved put out key regulations that basically allow employers to do some more sort of integrated benefits where they can include health reimbursement arrangements and use that to help people pay for coverage on the individual market. So why do people in retirement care? Well, this is all part of the idea of the the convergence of health and retirement, and we're likely to continue seeing that. Two quick takeaways from the guidance. As I've already said, number one is the regulators gave us guidance saying that you could use a health reimbursement arrangement, which isn't an HSA, but kind of feels like it a little bit, with the individual market exchange coverage, and employers might move to that a little bit. There's lots of debate, but it ties into the, well, what about the HSA discussion? Number two, for any of you who've ever seen all the healthcare offerings at a big employer, there's also the accepted benefit health reimbursement HRA, the EBHRA, as some of our colleagues call it. This accepted benefit HRA can pay for certain things that may not be covered sort of through healthcare. It's kind of similar to like flexible spending accounts. We could spend a lot of time here, but the key takeaway is there is a whole new set of expanded vehicles on the horizon once the regulators finish this guidance to add to the HSA discussion coming with HRA. So we'll hopefully have more to say on that in the future as the worlds continue to collide. Kevin, anything you want to add?
So David, I think you've covered that topic pretty well. So I'm going to give just two quick hits on other guidance that came out this week that could be interesting to people out there. The first is that IRS did its annual update of the contribution limits and the retirement plan limits. So for a defined contribution plan, the maximum employee elective deferral for 2018 is $18,500. Next year, it's going to be $19,000. People are also generally interested in knowing what the catch-up contribution limit's going to be, and there was no change. 2018, it's $6,000. 2019, it's also going to be $6,000. But kind of from a more abstract point, the SEC also released a proposed rule this week related to variable annuities and variable life insurance products. And it really fits with a trend we've seen with SEC guidance, including Form CRS, the proposal, a little bit with the fiduciary rule from the Department of Labor. And it's a real transition towards away from just kind of voluminous disclosure to layered disclosure. And the idea here is that when you're selling or when you're offering a variable annuity product to an individual, you're going to be able to satisfy, if this rule gets final, you'd be able to satisfy your obligation to provide the prospectus by providing a summary prospectus. And the SEC explains that a lot of this comes from the idea that the typical variable annuity prospectus is about 150 to 300 pages, and 3% of people read it. So maybe it's super helpful, but nobody's looking at them. So the SEC seems to think that a way to get people more information more quickly and that they actually get that information is by allowing a short form summary document. And I think this is a trend that we're seeing more from securities law regulators, but it's going to be interesting to watch as it develops.
Yeah, it's almost like a summary plan description, guys, for a retirement plan. So, that short form, if people aren't reading 150 pages, hey, give them something that's more consumable, as long as they can ask the questions of whomever they're buying the products for. I'm definitely for that. David, I love the conversation around health reimbursement accounts. That's awesome. And I agree, it's a convergence of retirement. Healthcare is a part of retirement. You're going to need health benefits in retirement. So it only makes natural sense that these worlds collide. I guess I'm wondering why people didn't think about this sooner. But in any event, guys, it's always a pleasure. And just a little tease for the audience, this is the first of two times I'm going to see the Legal Eagles. And we're going to tease it out a little bit later today. We're recording on Friday for our Sunday show. And I'll tease it out maybe a little bit behind the scenes when I see them again. So Eagles, always a pleasure to talk to you on the podcast. And I'm really looking forward to seeing you again in person a little bit later this afternoon.
Absolutely. We look forward
to it.
Bye, guys. Have a great weekend. Well, that wraps up another great week of the Weekly Pulse podcast. Hope you found the information helpful. We enjoyed certainly going around the globe and summarizing the issues related to retirement, the markets, technology, and personal finance. Special thanks to Michael Bozzello from StockTwits. I thought that was a great segment and a really interesting platform. Thank you to our contributors who make time out of their busy schedules to share their insights and expertise. And thank you, of course, to you, the audience. Thanks for joining us, and we look forward to having you back next week on the Weekly Pulse.